It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the Wisconsin Dugout Canoe Survey Project and the growing number of hollowed-out canoes inventoried through this effort. Carved from a single tree trunk, they appear in private collections. They rest at the bottom of lakes. And centuries-old dugout canoes, they were vital resources in food gathering and transportation for Native Americans. Call in with a question. You can share thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Cecil Schrader is an anthropology professor at UW-Madison whose lab hosts this survey project. Cecil, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much, Kate. It's a real pleasure to be here.
And Tamara Thompson here as well, a maritime archaeologist at the State Historic Preservation Office of the Wisconsin Historical Society. Tamara, welcome back.
Good morning.
Good morning. Well, Tamara, let's start with you. In less than 6 years, the survey project has documented 90 of these historical vessels. Where are they being found?
So we had an intern from University of Wisconsin-Madison come to our office and ask if he could do a project that eventually rolled into a senior thesis for him. His name is Ryan Smozzel. And he started doing the research and looking in collections for dugout canoes to complete a comparative analysis. And when he finished his work, we started with 11 and we knew where there were 34. He had visited 26, and Cecil and I decided, well, we'll help finish his project and this could result in some papers for him. But then COVID struck and we ended up doing a little bit more archival research, and we've uncovered more than 90 canoes that are in collections, private collections, those in historical society, and even those that are still on the bottom of lakes across Wisconsin.
Wow. Did you anticipate that it would be this number? I mean, why are these canoes, why do they seem to be so prolific?
Well, they were a very common use of the trees in our landscape, and they very easily could be crafted by those that knew how to do them, and they've been made by Native peoples all along.
Cecil, we know, you know, as Tamara says there, we know the waterways have been essential. They've been sacred to Native cultures for fishing, for gathering rice. How instrumental are these dugout canoes in both practical terms, but also in the cultural aspect?
The dugout canoes would have been really essential just for basic transportation in our state, which has so many lakes and so many waterways. But they were used for a variety of purposes. They were used for fishing, for wild ricing, as was mentioned, for sport, for you know, all different kinds of things. And so they were pretty central, I think, culturally to these societies that lived in the ancient Native peoples in Wisconsin lived around the lakes and along the rivers of the state.
And I understand you've found dugout canoes displayed on the wall of a small town hardware store, in the rafters of a barn. You know, what makes people want to preserve these canoes?
They're an object that is so easy to recognize once you pull it out of the water. And so many people across this state kayak and canoe that when they see an ancient one, it just is, it's a, I think it's a really special touchstone for them that connects the past with the present. Mm-hmm. And so they want to do something to help preserve it.
We're talking about the Wisconsin Dugout Canoe Survey Project underway with UW-Madison anthropology professor Cecil Schrader and state maritime archaeologist Tamara Thompson with us. You can join in with your questions and comments along the way. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tamara, so these dugout canoes ranging in length from 14 feet to 34 feet, made from a variety of tree species. What are you learning about how these canoes were put together?
Oh, they're, everyone thinks that they've seen one dugout canoe, and they've seen them all, but they're all so very different. So stylistically, as you said, in length, but also they evolved over time. And that's one of the things that we'll be doing when in this analysis. We've collected a small wood sample from each one of the canoes that we've visited, and we're looking for wood type. We're having the wood analyzed right now at the Forest Products Research Laboratory. And then very shortly, we'll be sending in all of the samples to be radiocarbon dated. So we'll have this picture of how these canoes were constructed and made over this vast expanse of time.
Can you go further there on the carbon testing process and what that might help you determine in with the age and other characteristics?
Sure. So we've taken a very, very small sample of wood. It's probably the size of your small fingernail. And from that sample, we're splitting them in half. One half again goes to Forest Products Research Laboratory for the wood type analysis. They're looking at the cellular structure of the wood, and they're able to break it down to maybe not the species level, but the genus level of the trees. So we'll know what trees were selected and harvested, or selected and grown to be harvested for dugout canoes. And then for the radiocarbon dating, those CISL has just received a grant funding from the University of Wisconsin to be able to send those samples off for analysis. And they will be able to put a range of time on each one of those watercraft. So right now, in the collections across the state, only 16 of those 90 dugout canoes have been radiocarbon dated. So we know a date range that tree had been harvested. But we're hoping to fill in the rest of the gaps and really be able to look at them not only across time, but across space, across our state.
Cecil, why is it important to get that approximation of the age of the tree?
Of reasons that that's really important. One is that it further demonstrates the antiquity of these watercraft in native cultures. A second one is that over the past 10,000 years, the climate changed and that affected vegetation in different parts of the state. And so if we have a wood type and a radiocarbon date, it can help us better understand why a particular wood species was chosen for making the dugout. For example, we have some dugouts that were made out of elm, which is a wood that is very difficult to work. It has an interlocking grain, and so it's almost impossible to split the log. And the dugouts, excuse me, the dugouts that we have that were made out of elm date to a time period around 3,000 years ago, when the climate in this region was a little bit warmer, and that affected the the ways in which oak trees and other species in southern Wisconsin were growing, and made elm a really suitable choice for people to make, because no matter what kind of environment the elm is growing in, it will grow a long straight trunk. Whereas oak trees, if they're growing in a warmer climate, are more likely to spread out and start branching fairly low to the ground, making them not a very well-suited trunk for making a dugout canoe.
Cecil Schrader with us, professor of anthropology specializing in archaeology at UW-Madison. Tamara Thompson is a maritime archaeologist in the State Historic Preservation Office, and together they run the Wisconsin Dugout Canoe Survey Project. And there's room for your questions and comments. Call 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Dozens of hollowed out canoes, some of that are centuries old, are being inventoried through the Wisconsin Dugout Canoe Survey Project. We explore discoveries in these vessels and the tree species that Native Americans used to craft them. And you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. The project is run by the State Historic Preservation Office, maritime archaeologist Tamara Thompson, and UW-Madison anthropologist Cecil Schrader. Let's take a call now. Bill in Madison. Bill, hi. You're a canoeist.
Hi. Yes, I am. I'm an avid canoeist and user of the lakes in Madison, and I really enjoyed doing that. And I was curious about the dugouts versus the more later model birch bark type canoes that the Native Americans used. And I was just curious if they have any idea how the two perform, pros and cons. And also, I'd like to thank the two researchers there. They do excellent work, and I've been following that. Greatly appreciated. So thank you.
Thank you, Bill, for the call. Tamara, go ahead.
So we believe that the dugout canoes were probably for a particular lake or body of water. They would have been difficult to portage. And so as populations moved around, as the resources moved, the canoes may have been left or cached in a particular lake, and then they would come back and use them season after season. For the birch barks, they were much more fragile. So we see reports of dugout canoe, or sorry, birch bark canoes having to be patched and repaired as they were being used for travel. So we believe that there were different uses for each type of canoe.
So archaeologists think that indigenous people purposely submerged dugout canoes as a way to preserve them. And Cecil, can you explain a bit further there? Why did they want to preserve them that way?
The Native peoples in Wisconsin were pretty nomadic, at least on a seasonal basis. And so given the weight of a dugout and the how it would be difficult to portage, it was often easier to just leave them at a spring, summer, fall settlement. And if they were left behind over the winter and they were left on surface, then they would get waterlogged. When the temperatures dropped, they would freeze and they would be more likely to crack. And so submerging them in the lake and keeping them wet was a really excellent way of preserving them as dugout canoes.
I've heard the terms, Tamara, like seasoned or curing the canoes in that manner.
Yeah, I think it may have been part of the original production process, and then it just further was a further use as they were a further way of treating them as they were used to help extend their lifespan.
Was that a common practice, Tamara, to make them that way? There was, I think, some oiling done and then submerging them?
Yes. So they, when the canoes are constructed, they're burned. The interior of the canoe is burned out and scraped with, in the earlier canoes, scraped with shells or in later ones with stone tools. And then in the burning process, it was usually an animal fat that could have been used to keep the burn in a certain area in combination with water in some of the other areas to prevent the burn from going. So as they cached the canoes, a lot of times they would cover them with the sediment of the bottom, the oozy bottom, clays and things like that would settle down into the cracks of the wood. And in a rocky bottom, sometimes larger rocks were placed inside the canoe to keep it stationary over the winter. And the place that they would cache them would be in about waist deep water so that they could easily be retrieved, but would be below where the ice sheet would come in that could damage them.
Oh, wow. That's really remarkable. And then they could find them again easily in the spring, or hopefully easily to retrieve them.
Hopefully. that was the plan. So is to put them somewhere that it would be a common place for them to come back to. So some sort of feature on the landscape that would indicate where to look.
Cecil, how have historical societies and tribal preservation officers assisted in this survey project?
They've been remarkable partners in this project. We wouldn't have been able to do it without their support and interest. Some of the tribal partners have even informed us about dugout canoes in locations that we had no idea there were. For example, Dave Greeno of the Menominee told us that there was a Menominee dugout at the Smithsonian Institution in DC. And so Tamara and I drove out there in January to document that dugout. The local historical societies have been really open and welcoming to us coming in and documenting their dugouts. And everybody that we've worked with has been kind enough to allow us to take these small wood samples so that we can extend our analyses in some additional directions.
Talking with UW-Madison anthropology professor Cecil Schrader there and state maritime archaeologist Tamara Thompson as we explore the latest on the Wisconsin Dugout Canoe Survey Project. You can join in. Questions and comments are welcome. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tamara, some of these canoes have holes that look like space for possibly supporting masts. Could these canoes have been sailboats as well?
Yes, absolutely. We're also we're finding a number of holes that are through the prow. Those may have been used for putting a lifting stick to carry them out of the water or drag them along a shoreline. And then we find these mysterious holes. Sometimes they will be up on the bow area, and sometimes they would be semi-sunk into the floor of the boat. And these could have been to support a mast, or they could have been used for night fishing. There's still some mystery that we're trying to solve with some of these features that we're finding.
I would imagine you're documenting and trying to find patterns among the boats and of their characteristics.
Yes, we are. Hopefully with this, with the radiocarbon dating, we'll be able to look at those features on some sort of constructive timeline. But we also find that some of the later canoes, the ones that are a little more modern, but still crafted by Native Americans, have what are called thwarts across the bottom. So they're either to add support to the floor of the vessel to prevent it from coming in or curling in, or they may have been to compartmentalize fish or rice that they would have been collecting in the boat. Or we even find that from some of the artwork that we've looked at, they could have been for standing and purchasing against for really digging a paddle in to move you across the lake.
Possibilities there. And Cecil, you're using a GoPro camera and a phone. You're creating 3D images of some of the dugout canoes and posted them online for people to look at. Why create these images?
When we started the project, it was in part because Ryan Smozzle, the student intern that was working on it, was interested in learning more about 3D imaging. But we also wanted to do it because, as Tamara mentioned earlier, each dugout is unique and different. And most institutions or collections have just a single dugout, and people tend to think when they see that dugout, that's what all dugouts look like. So this is a way of making the variation in dugout form and style widely accessible to more people.
We have just a few seconds left, Tamara, but is there an end in sight? When will the survey project conclude?
We always think that there's an end in sight, and then we do a show like this and
more
will send
surface
us an email. Well, I don't know. It would be nice to have a nice round number like 100, but people are going to have to search their basements and attics and give us a call.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tamara Thompson, maritime archaeologist with the State Historic Preservation Office at the Wisconsin Historical Society. And Cecil Schrader, UW-Madison anthropology professor specializing in archaeology, lab hosting the Wisconsin Dugout Canoe Survey Project. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the work of recovery high schools and providing a supportive environment for students with a substance use disorder. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about one family's annual food tradition.
Deer hunting is a family tradition for many people in Wisconsin. But what do you do with the venison once you get home? As Brianna Ruppel tells us, her family in northern Wisconsin gets together to cold smoke sausage.
It's a blustery January morning, and four generations of my family have stomped the snow off their boots and reunited in a Marathon County basement to take part in an annual tradition.
Yeah, does anybody want coffee or a Bloody Mary?
Scattered on chairs, tables, even on top of the washing machine, are bowls of raw meat.
They're done with gun season, bow season, and everybody around here has venison.
Of course, these hunters could just take their harvested meat to a processor in town who will have it ready in a couple of hours. So why not skip the work?
It's a reward for a good hunt is what it amounts to, really.
That's my grandpa, Bob Schwartz. The technique they'll use is called cold smoking, a meat preservation method used by many northern cultures around the world for thousands of years.
The expert right here has been doing this for a long time.
That expert? My uncle, Bob Yonke, who continues to pass on the German traditions he learned at his family's smokehouse just 3 miles down the dirt road.
Oh, boy. Got to be 45 years ago. And been doing it ever since.
Yonke has modernized a few of the mechanisms from the old days, though they still have that rustic Wisconsin ingenuity. Now he's rigged up a grinder to a motor with a gear reduction.
You can see how fine it gets then. It doesn't get all curled up in the blade.
This is Bob's son, Scott Yonke, who was about 10 when he and his brother started learning from their dad. Of course, food traditions are nothing without the secret ingredient.
Everybody says, oh, this tastes good. How do you season it? Oh, we can't tell you. Just eat some more.
Throughout history, different families and butchers could be distinguished by their own unique blend of seasonings. Because the meat is not cooked to 160 degrees, it technically remains raw. Though smoke is both an antimicrobial and antioxidant, it's not enough to safely preserve raw meat.
You have to have some cure in it, otherwise you could get sick.
Now the crew will squeeze the seasoned and cured meat into 2-pound sticks using a stuffer initially intended to run on water pressure that Yonke has converted to run on air. Everyone grabs a stack to haul up the narrow staircase and out back to the smokehouse. In 1995, Yonke built this smokehouse out of cement. His grandchildren's tiny handprints from nearly 30 years ago still there in the floor. Generally, meat is smoked using hardwood.
Apple, cherry, and hickory.
Yonke stacks the wood in a small pit dug into the floor of the smokehouse. He controls the size of the fire by sliding a heavy iron lid to increase or decrease the opening.
This is the adjuster, how you regulate the heat.
The goal is to keep the temperature inside the smokehouse below 80 degrees. Yonke keeps a close watch on his fire, often checking on it 3 times a day. Nature controls the time frame, but Yonke uses weight to tell when the sticks are ready.
And when they lose 20% of their weight, then they're done. And that usually takes a little over a week.
Yankee stands without a visible shiver in winds that blow a rush of white across his land. He looks content in knowing the tradition of cold smoking will be carried on through the hands of generations to come. Surely they too will be taught the most secret ingredient of all, patience.
Brianna Ruppel brought us that story on cold smoking sausage. She's a writer who now lives in Michigan. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Dozens of recovery schools nationwide serve students with diagnosed substance use disorders. Wisconsin has one such high school. We explore this educational model as the state health department tracks rising opioid-related deaths over the past decade. Call in with a question. You can share comments at any point, 800-642-1234. Michael Dirschlag is chair of the Association of Recovery Schools. Michael, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You direct Peace Academy in Minnesota, acronym PEERS, Enjoying a Sober Education, longest running recovery high school nationwide. How is a day at a recovery high school different from a day at other high schools?
You know, that's a really good question. It doesn't differ all that much because we are schools. So we're not treatment centers. We're not like aftercare programs. So we're schools. So students have a full day of academic classes. I think what separates us from other schools is we have additional supports that support the young people in their continued recovery. And so many of us have licensed alcohol and drug counselors. There might be peer recovery specialists. And I think the staff across the country who work in recovery high schools are very knowledgeable about substance use disorder or substance misuse and how to better serve the students. And lastly, all the students there are committed to recovery. And so how they open up to each other and support each other and really act as peers to one another as they kind of move forward is unique to the schools.
I wonder if their experiences are incorporated into the curriculum.
Frequently, yes. You know, I think any good curriculum will try to draw on the students' experiences and what they're raised with. And so for all of our students who are, you know, who have experienced substance misuse, I think that is probably a common theme in the classroom.
Our state's only recovery high school is Horizon High School in Madison, and our latest state budget includes $500,000 to fund new and existing recovery schools. What would you say are the biggest challenges to running a recovery school?
Oh, you know, I think one of the biggest challenges that I face, and I've been with Pease Academy for a little over 28 years, is the fluctuating enrollment. Because, you know, we have to be open for when students are ready, need to be here. And so they come throughout the year and sometimes they leave. So I think that's one of the biggest challenges is sustainable funding that supports the school regardless of average daily membership. Hardships probably include continuing to fight the stigma of substance use disorder. I think it's very difficult for families to make the decision that their child might need a school that has these additional supports.
I do wonder, how do students find you? Do you get referrals from area school districts?
You know, in Minnesota, and I think each state's going to be very different. So sometimes it is. Oftentimes the schools who refer, like I'm thinking in Texas specifically, are referring to specific schools. But, you know, most of our referrals in Minnesota actually come from the treatment centers. Minnesota, even though we've seen a significant decline in adolescent treatment facilities, we still have a lot compared to other states. So really staying in touch with those treatment facilities who then refer students to us. And the other is word of mouth, both families and the young people when they meet other young people. And we still get some referrals from the traditional school districts. I think the problem is that most school districts don't don't have chemical health specialists within the schools, and so many just don't understand the true impact of this deadly disease.
How do recovery high schools decide who to admit and who to turn away?
You know, again, I think it depends on not only state to state, but school to school. You know, as a for us at Pease Academy, we recognize that not every student is going to have the same access, or every young person is going to have the same access to treatment, and that's an equity issue. So, if a young person who comes to us who's committed to working towards or already in a abstinence-based recovery program, because we are talking about adolescents, then they're welcome to be here. And so that's really kind of our criteria. Now, we're also a public charter school, Pease Academy. So in Minnesota, that means we are open to any student who wants to come here. And really, once they decide to come here, they have to follow the same rules as any other student. Some states or some different schools, they may have different criteria, like successful completion of a treatment program. This one's kind of going a little bit by the wayside, but there used to be requirements at some schools where you had to have 30 days of abstinence.
Michael, is a public charter educational model, is that a good fit? I mean, should recovery high schools be public or private or charter? What model fits best?
That really depends on the local situation. You know, there was a hope that you could take a model and just put it down wherever. But the Association of Recovery Schools really takes best practices from across different kinds of schools. In Minnesota, we have five of the six recovery schools here are actually run through traditional districts at their area learning centers. Pease Academy is the only public charter in Minnesota. I just came back from Charlotte, North Carolina, and they have a wonderful recovery school there that is a private school. So it really depends on the local local landscape.
When you say wonderful, I just wonder in Charlotte, what solutions are they doing? What are they doing differently there that you could implement elsewhere?
I really think, one thing that's in common there is that everything is that they've really created a atmosphere of belonging. And I think that's where it starts. But they've done a really amazing job of also providing safe space that it kind of expands that idea, traditional idea of recovery, to also include those who are in recovery from mental health issues.
Oh, okay. Because it's not just substance use in isolation. There can also be other layers of recovery going on.
Oh gosh, yes. I think recovery high schools have known that for a long time, but we're seeing a real push towards breaking down those silos in the treatment world. So co-occurring diagnoses are very common for our students.
Michael Dirschlag is chair of the Association of Recovery Schools, directs Pease Academy. That's a recovery high school charter in Minneapolis. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new grant program in Wisconsin is designed to help fund and expand recovery high schools in the state. One exists now. Recovery schools are for teens recovering from a substance use disorder who may also be dealing with a related mental health disorder. Call in with a question you can add to the discussion. The number is 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Michael Dirschlag chairs the Association of Recovery Schools, director of Pease Academy. That's a recovery school in Minneapolis. Michael, the medical side here, there's research in the Journal of Adolescent Health showing most children with opioid use disorder don't receive medication treatment like methadone, buprenorphine, and the research cites barriers like stigma and cost. How should recovery schools approach medication for substance use disorder?
Well, one is that, recovery high schools are not medical facilities, so recovery high schools aren't going to be the ones who prescribe. But I do think, and that's how PEASE Academy operates, and a lot of recovery high schools that I know of, is that we work with the medical field and support medically assisted pathways to recovery. And so when I say we work with that, you know, we get releases of information to kind of be in communication with the healthcare professional if needed to discuss medication doses. But we support the evidence based practices. And I just know that it used to be really just for 18 and over, but we are seeing a trend where we're adequately treating youth who have opioid substance use disorders with medically assisted therapies.
Do you imagine that trend will continue?
I think so. I don't see why it wouldn't. And it really kind of, I think, depends on the pendulum swing of the medical professional and the treatment world, because recovery high schools are really traditionally are what comes after treatment. And so to kind of support the youth in their continued recovery. And if a school is that initial engagement in recovery, they may be the ones who are referring to healthcare professionals to try to help stabilize the young person.
How should schools handle a student who relapses and, you know, uses drugs or alcohol?
You know, I think each recovery high school is going to have to grapple and define policies and procedures that make sense for them. And, you know, for PEASE Academy, we really stress honesty and peer accountability. And if a student just wants to use, then this probably isn't the right school for them yet. Even if they want to just kind of use periodically, it's just probably not the right school for them yet, because unfortunately, you know, even though I might personally be a big supporter of harm reduction, you know, for adolescents, there's not a lot of research or any research that kind of supports even moderate substance use for youth. But the other part about it is that we have to, I think, maintain places of more abstinence-based recovery, because if you try to mix the two too much, those who use will bring down those who want to stay abstinent quicker than the reverse. But if a young person is committed to staying abstinent, if they experience a reoccurrence of use, then they just kind of work with the support staff here, and they kind of create a plan how to get back on track and stabilize, and then that plan is communicated to everybody who needs to know. You know, if they continue to use, it might mean they need additional services, so we try to help them get that.
I want to pick up on that word peer accountability. I mean, we've heard the term peer pressure. Do you see, you know, peer support integral to this recovery process?
I think it's absolutely essential. You know, our school, when it was founded in 1989, it was the students themselves who named it kind of probably a couple months after the opening. And they recognized even in the beginning that peers enjoying a sober education, how important that is. We know from the research that for an adolescent, their peer group is the number one most important influence in their lives, which is sometimes a blow for parents, but that's true. And so, if we can create environments where their peers, their social situation is one that is geared towards recovery and making positive choices, then I think that is going to rub off on those people around them. And just the opposite of that, if we take a young person who's committed to recovery or wants to be in recovery, we put them back in the traditional schools, we also know that that is not a recipe for success, as the research shows that over 97% of adolescents who return to their home school after treatment are offered drugs the first day. And again, it's not the schools, it's the peers that they're associated with.
Schools here in Wisconsin, they're grappling with truancy. And I'm just wondering, how are absences handled in recovery schools? Because our high schools here in Wisconsin are grappling with our state lawmakers, are looking at it, really trying to tackle that issue of a lot of absences.
You know, I think what's amazing is that most of the students that we get to work with every single day have had serious and significant truancy issues prior to coming to us. And in that recovery, when we talk about recovery, it's not just putting down substance misuse, it's also kind of changing behaviors. And so our students see and this is across the country, see a significant increase in daily attendance. They tend to want to be at our schools because of the environment that we've been able to create, as well as the education they're getting. And then if students fall into kind of, start missing some absences, because we're typically smaller, I think we can take a much more individualized approach, try to work with the families and the students to kind of try to get them to where they want to be. And then we follow, state truancy laws.
Talking with the Association of Recovery Schools, as Wisconsin provides new funding for schools that specialize in the treatment of substance use disorders. Michael Derschlag is here, and you can join in. Questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Michael, at some point they will leave your school, that transition to the next step. What is transition like for students after they graduate and leave?
Well, I think it's really good. Over 87% of our graduates at the time of graduation have applied to and been accepted to a program of their choice. And so we're looking to, a lot of our students go to 4-year colleges or universities. They go to 2-year community colleges, specific job training programs or technical schools, and even the military. And so we really try to work with the students to help them think beyond high school. And while they're with us, they are also working on developing and maintaining a strong recovery program that's outside of the school day. So we're leaning in on those community-based recovery support groups. And my favorite thing is to do is to try to hand them off or encourage students to look at colleges and universities or a community college that have collegiate recovery programs, because we see a lot of success if they go from a recovery high school and then go to a collegiate recovery program. Then they get that continued support and they have a built-in community already there. And so we're actually, the Association of Recovery Schools actually works closely with the Association of Recovery and Higher Education, because we see the importance of that bridge and transition to that next step.
In our last moments together, do you have one piece of advice to better work with communities to support a new recovery high school in Wisconsin?
Yes, because I think that, sometimes we look at young people who use they're bad people, and we don't want those kind of us young people in our backyards. And what I know is that there are kids, and substance misuse does not discriminate. And so, and once they're in recovery, they usually start making much better choices. And it's okay to rally around this great idea to support recovery high schools. And I'll say the Association of Recovery Schools is set up to help different communities through technical assistance and ongoing support to get a recovery high school off the ground, as well as sustain them as they move forward.
Michael, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. It's great to be here this morning.
Michael Derschlag, Chair of the Association of Recovery Schools, directs Pease Academy in Minnesota. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. UW-Madison is tapped to lead a nationwide study to advance clinical care for Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia. We learn about the 5-year study and hear from you. Call in with a question, share comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sterling Johnson is a professor of medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and the study's leader. Sterling, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. It's great to be here this morning.
Well, give us a glimpse into how this $150 million will be used over the next 5 years for dementia research.
Thank you. This is an extraordinary opportunity for not just UW-Madison, but for our whole field to get a better idea of how often Alzheimer's disease occurs in the brain, how early it occurs, and also what other forms of dementia might be co-occurring alongside Alzheimer's disease. And the reason that is so important is because we now know that Alzheimer's disease usually does not occur by itself. It usually occurs with at least one other brain condition. And this is understandable as we age. More than one thing might be going on in the brain.
So you've been there's the term mixed dementia, and that really speaks to this research?
It really does, yeah. We're focused, of course, on Alzheimer's disease because that's the most common mm-hmm. cause of dementia. But there's other things that happen too. One of them is vascular dementia, and vascular disease is a common problem in the brain as we age. And when a person has both, they might decline faster in terms of their cognitive abilities and their course towards dementia. But there's also other what we call proteinopathies. Alzheimer's disease, at its core, it's a proteinopathy. There's two proteins that become dysregulated and they cause the plaques and tangles, which we can talk about. But there's other proteinopathies, and one of them causes Lewy body disease. And another one causes a new type of dementia called limbic predominant age-related TDP-43 encephalopathy. These are conditions that may happen alongside Alzheimer's disease that we're now positioned to be able to identify and study.
And the mixture of conditions would be different than, you know, a different treatment course along the way might also then,
That's right.
be guiding physicians as they try to figure out what are the next steps for treatment.
That's right. Each person's different. Mm. Each person's different. Their Alzheimer's disease may begin in their mid-50s for one person and their 70s for another person, and their symptoms may not be present till 20 years later. And then the mixture of these other kinds of causes of cognitive impairment may be present to varying degrees, and they may, the timing of each of these additional factors may be different. And that's the challenge, as to how to identify these things in the individual patient so that we can improve their care, so that we can get them on the right treatment and have the right expectations for that treatment as well.
We're talking about Alzheimer's and dementia research. Sterling Johnson here, professor of medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. You can join in with your questions and your comments, 800-642-1234. One aim of the study is to develop a standardized test for analyzing hallmark biomarkers of Alzheimer's. What do you mean by hallmark biomarkers?
Yeah, biomarkers are the way we look at the brain. They're our tool to understand what's going on. So a biomarker is just a measurement of a biological process. And in this case, we're looking at the hallmark signs of Alzheimer's disease that's what we're anchoring ourselves to as a study. And that would be those amyloid plaques and the neurofibrillary tangles, the plaques and tangles. Those are the two big features of Alzheimer's disease. And we can actually see those with some advanced brain imaging techniques that all of these Alzheimer's centers have the capability of using.
You mean like PET scans, spinal taps?
That's right.
Yeah.
PET scans and lumbar punctures, we used to call those spinal taps, but they're a way of getting these lumbar punctures are a way of getting the fluid that actually bathes the brain. And in that fluid, we can look for these different protein combinations that tell us if there's amyloid plaques in the brain and tau related, that's the other protein with Alzheimer's, tau related changes. But we can also look for other proteins in that spinal fluid, such as alpha-synuclein or other indicators of other diseases. But really this study is we're gonna focus on those imaging techniques because that's what is most accessible to our participants and something that we think more people will be able and willing to do.
Yes.
These imaging techniques can help us understand when the plaques and tangles appear and how how long they've been there and how fast they're growing.
Yes, these participants in the study, what might they encounter along the way as you follow them? What will they go through?
They will come in and go through several different types of imaging. One would be this amyloid PET scan that looks for amyloid plaques. And another imaging procedure would be a tau PET scan that looks for these neurofibrillary tangles and also where the image helps us see where they are in the brain. And then we would do an MRI scan as well. And in some cases, we would also be doing the more a more standard type of PET scan called a glucose PET scan. And then they'll come back a couple of years later for those same kinds of scans. But the other thing that we'll be gathering alongside those images is blood. And that's something we can talk about because it's now possible to detect some of these diseases with a blood test. Yeah. And we'll be evaluating new tests as we go along and using established tests as well.
Very curious about that. There are a bunch of new blood tests that doctors can order now, trying to figure out whether their patient with memory loss also has Alzheimer's disease. What do you know? What can you tell us about these blood tests?
Right now, most of them are available for research so that we can evaluate them and know how good they're going to be in different stages of Alzheimer's disease. But there's some that are commercially available, and there's many that are available for researchers that allow us to look in the blood and see if these amyloid proteins and the tau proteins are there. And what we're learning so far is that they're almost as accurate as these very fancy and advanced imaging, PET scan imaging procedures. And that's really exciting because that means that we'll be able to get these diagnostic techniques out to the community in a way that improves their care. And that's one of our major goals of this study, is to bring confidence to the community about the value of these, the value and usefulness of these blood markers.
So you're saying that these blood tests could ultimately better detect the buildup of these plaques and tangles in the brain, and that test could be ordered, and then you could also be able to figure out where that person is with the condition.
That's right. That's the goal. We're not there yet, and that's part of the goal of this research, is to bring us closer to that reality. We think it'll happen.
Sterling Johnson is a professor of medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, leading a neurobiology study into Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. You can call in with a question. You can share your perspective along the way at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. UW-Madison will lead a $150 million study involving dozens of Alzheimer's disease research centers around the country. We explore what the five-year study will entail and hear from you. Call in with a question. You can add your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sterling Johnson is a clinical neuropsychologist and on the geriatrics faculty at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, study leader. Sterling, your study working with 37 Alzheimer's Disease Research Center covering over 17,000 patients. How complicated is working with that many people, that many research groups?
We're finding out it is quite complicated. But these centers are really the most qualified and expert research workforce in the country. They see complicated patients. They're well attuned to the kind of things that we're doing. But even so, there's lots of logistics with a study this big.
I would imagine, too, you'll have to prioritize the different aspects of what you need investigated and figuring out how to disperse that among all these research centers, and based on their expertise.
That's right. And we do have, it's really a, it's a big team, and it involves several institutions to help us coordinate this, not just UW-Madison, but also the other UW, University of Washington in Seattle, and Stanford University, and several others who will be part of our administrative team and help us solve the logistics and help these centers get the resources they need to achieve our study results.
You are recruiting participants who are at least 55 and are experiencing either mild dementia or no current impairment. Why start there?
Well, it's that's a great question. First of all, this disease, Alzheimer's disease, can happen. Well, it can start many years before its symptoms. And so we do need to start with people who are not symptomatic. And we want to track how this project, how this disease unfolds and develops over the course of a person's older adult lifespan. But we're also very interested in the people with mild cognitive impairment and mild dementia, because that's where this idea of mixed dementia really comes into play. By the time a person has cognitive symptoms, they may be experiencing not just Alzheimer's, but some additional co-pathology that we talked about.
Jean from Green Bay called in to ask how people might be able to become participants in the study.
That's a great question. It's going to involve participants who are already participating in an Alzheimer's disease research center. And we have an Alzheimer's disease research center here in Madison at adrc.wisc.edu is how people can get to that. And they can sign up for participation in the ADRC there.
Okay, so looking more closely now at Alzheimer's disease, the National Institutes of Health, where this funding is coming from, also had a study finding binge drinking among middle-aged adults is at its highest levels in at least a decade. Does alcohol use affect the risk of dementia?
It does. Alcohol use and other bad habits or health characteristics that we might have can all increase our risk for dementia. We don't know how much. The alcohol use has its own type of dementia that occurs with chronic use, of course, but we know that anything we do that's not good for our brain, that's going to result in fewer neurons or brain cells, is ultimately not going to be good for our ability to buffer and show some resilience to these diseases that might be occurring. I don't think alcohol or any of these other lifestyle choices and health factors are going to impact when the plaques start or how fast those plaques grow in the brain, but they might affect our brain's ability to cope with these diseases, and they might hasten the course of a person's cognitive impairment and dementia.
Maddie from Green Bay called in to ask, how long will it be before doctors can determine what is happening in the brain with tests or scans rather than verbal tests of memory and other oral type tests to gauge memory and cognitive
that's a
function?
Great question.
Yeah.
Yeah. Usually in the clinic, what we do is we do these tests that require us to actually test your memory, test a person's memory and their thinking skills. Those are really important to help us gauge how affected that person is and whether it's dementia or not. So those tests probably won't go away, but these biomarker tests, the imaging, the blood tests, the spinal fluid tests, those are becoming available now for us to know conclusively who has Alzheimer's and who doesn't. And I think over the next 5 years, we will see more and more of these capabilities rolled out to the community clinics, especially the blood markers. We know that these PET scans can't be done in all communities. They're usually just done in these large academic medical centers. Where we're trying to go is to bridge these very complicated technical procedures to simple to use blood biomarkers. And we think that'll happen easily over the next 5 years.
How is research progressing then on fighting further Alzheimer's and other dementias in terms of fighting the plaques in the brain and you know, breaking up these tangles or trying to find some cures?
That's where our field is having so much exciting breakthroughs right now. We do have drugs. One of them is FDA approved already that will go in and find these plaques and break them down and remove these plaques completely in some cases. And there's more drugs on the way that will be in this class of medicine that finds the plaques and removes them completely from the brain. This is such a remarkable time for our field, such a hopeful time for patients who are affected by this disease or who may be affected in the near future.
So this class of medicine is moving somewhat in parallel to the research you're doing in diagnosis and looking at mixed dementia.
Yeah, it is. It's happening in parallel, and it really raises the importance of what we're doing because we need to find the right patients for these treatments. They're not going to be applicable to everybody, and we need to find the right patients for these drugs and also have the right expectations on these drugs that they may benefit some people more than others, depending on how much additional pathology might be present. And if they do have these other pathologies, we want to make sure they're treated as best as we can for those coexisting conditions. And that's so ultimately we're working towards the same goal of improving the quality of life and the care and management of our patients.
Talking with clinical neuropsychologist Sterling Johnson, professor of medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, study leader on this new National Institutes of Health study on Alzheimer's disease and biomarkers. You can join in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. The United Kingdom-based Alzheimer's Society says dementia is more common among people who suffer hearing loss when they're middle-aged. Why is dementia more common among people who suffer hearing loss in that age group?
That's a mystery. I don't know the answer to that question. It's something that our field is working on, and hopefully we will have answers in the near future. But I'm not sure why that link is there.
And what can people do to lower their risk of developing dementia? Anything they can do today?
We do believe that a healthy lifestyle and controlling our chronic medical conditions, our vascular health especially, will be important for keeping the brain healthy. The healthier our brain is, the more likely it is to absorb these plaques and tangles and other proteinopathies for longer. And that's why we still recommend a healthy lifestyle and good control of our health so that we do have a little bit of a buffer in case one of these diseases is present in our brain now or will be in the future. It'll benefit, we're still not sure. We can't put a number on how much benefit an individual will get, but we do think it's important.
In our last moments together, how will this research correlate or migrate or work with the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention?
That's a lot of the ideas for this research came out of the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention. And those participants have gone through a lot of these same biomarkers themselves and have made possible this national study, which, that's such a great testament to the great work that RAP is doing and the amazing participants that we have in that study.
Sterling, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks, Kate.
Sterling Johnson is a UW School of Medicine and Public Health professor of medicine leading a new National Institutes of Health study into Alzheimer's disease. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.
Mm.
That is the Back to the Future movie soundtrack on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It sets us up to discuss the time-traveling DeLorean, the iconic sports car made famous in the 1980s film franchise. A 1981 DeLorean was recently discovered in a barn in Dousman in southeastern Wisconsin. Call in with a question, share thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Michael McElhattan is owner of DeLorean Midwest in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Mike, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Good morning. Well, pick up the story from here. You're notified a 90-year-old man living in Dousman near Waukesha wants to sell a 1981 DeLorean. What happens next?
Yeah, so originally this phone call came in from New Mexico, and I got a note on my desk that said, gentlemen, a Mark in New Mexico wants to talk about a DeLorean for sale. And so I'm thinking, well, New Mexico is about 1,300 miles from the shop, so that's a bit of a challenge. But apart getting a hold of Mark, I found out the car he's talking about is owned by his uncle, who's 90. His name is Dick, and he's about 60 miles north of the shop. And then he let me know this is a barn find with only 977 miles on it.
Wow, a barn find. Okay, so how do you know the odometer reading is authentic, 977 miles?
Well, that's a good question, but, there's cues that we can pick up on being around these cars for so long. And once we got up to Dousman to see this car, we were able to realize it has original tires on it that show very low mileage. And the wear on the car overall is extremely low. The odometer is still working on the car, and these are all signs that point to the mileage being accurate. Dick actually was the original owner of this car, but it was sold to him 10 years after the car came out in 1991, because the dealer had kept it for them for their personal vehicle for 10 years.
Oh, wow. Okay. So, but why is mileage, how important is this car being driven so few miles? Why does mileage matter so much?
Well, it's just kind of a general rule of collector cars is the lower the mileage, the more the car is worth. But there are challenges with lower mileage cars because this has obviously spent so much time off the road.
Yes.
And there are certain items that, the fuel system, especially on a DeLorean, needs pretty gone through because with ethanol in the fuels, that usually causes a full rebuild of the fuel system when they've been sitting like that.
So compare the condition of this DeLorean versus others that come your way in the shop.
Well, it's kind of funny because it's a bit of a diamond in the rough because the car was absolutely filthy. It was the first vehicle I've worked on. I've been working on DeLoreans for 17 years and found all kinds of barn finds that customers bring in. Mainly we repair and restore cars for customers. So we've seen all kinds of mouse remnants in cars. This is the first time I opened up a door and we saw live mice running through the car. So that's kind of a challenge. The car is, filthy on the outside. It's got mouse droppings on the inside. But the cool thing about it is underneath all that dirt, there's a really great low mileage car underneath.
And you did a great job documenting the mice scurrying about. I think that's the image that we all have of the video posted. So in a situation like that, where the car is, well, it's infested. It has homes to mice and perhaps other things. How do you go about cleaning and then start that conditioning?
Yeah, well, we're hoping so we've started with the exterior of the car. So we got the exterior of the car cleaned, and then we regrained the stainless, which is kind of the equivalent of painting a car because, of course, the DeLorean is unpainted stainless steel.
Yes.
There's no coating on it. So you can kind of – there's a process that we call regraining the car, which is kind of just making the grain of the car look nice and fresh. And so basically the exterior of the car looks very much the part of a low-mileage, nice DeLorean. We're pretty much done with that part of it. The inside is our next challenge, and that'll start with us probably gutting the interior. I hope to keep it as original as possible and to get any of those odors and remnants of the mice out. So we'll probably remove all of the interior, pressure wash all the carpets, deodorize them, and then hope to be able to remove all the odors so we can reinstall the original stuff.
I've never sat in one myself. How do you open the doors and get in? What is that like?
Yeah, so the doors are definitely unique. They're what, you know, they call gull wing doors. And it opens, there's a door handle where you just kind of release it and it goes up on its own when there's a torsion bar and a door strut that help to assist the door to lift up on its own. But that should that, if those are installed and adjusted.
Did we just lose Mike? I think we might have lost Mike. We're talking about efforts to restore a 1981 DeLorean. It was found in a barn in Douseman. Mike McElhattan is the owner of DeLorean Midwest. Mike, are you still there?
I'm here.
Okay, great. Well, let me just finish my spiel here. Call in with questions and comments. 800-642-1234. So, you know, okay, so we've opened the doors. Now, when you get in, what stands out to you about the console or sitting in the driver's seat? What do you feel? What do you see?
The interior feels very 80s, and DeLorean was a bit ahead of his time, where by this time in 1981, he had kind of eliminated all the earlier chrome and stuff you would see in the interior. And they come with either a black interior or a gray interior. But, you know, he used quality items. So there's luxury leather inside the car. The cars all came loaded with options, power windows, power locks, AM, FM cassettes, air conditioning, which was about all you got for options in 1981.
The windows, to me, when I look at pictures, they seem smaller. What are the windows like?
Yeah, the windows are small. So there's an upper portion of the glass on the door that's called a fixed glass, so that does not move. And then there's a smaller drop glass, and it's been referred to as a toll booth window, where it's good enough for, you know, you'll remember the old days when you had to throw change into the toll booth.
yes, I do.
The nice thing about the car is you only need 14 inches to open the door fully, and so carefully when you go through a drive-through, it's easier to open the door fully than try to fit your Happy Meal through that tiny window.
Really? So it's visually, though, it seems like those door wings would really take up a lot more space.
Yeah, it's a really big door, but since it mainly goes up, the movement outward is only, like I say, 14 inches.
Okay. Is the car fun to drive? How does it handle?
Yeah, so the frame and suspension design on this car was done by Lotus, and it's a really nice handling car. It's a good cruiser. And for its time, the handling on it, I thought was, you know, very good. So it's a nice car for a curvy country road.
What about a day when there's snow coming down? Would you be driving one today?
Well, you know, oddly enough, they actually get great traction in the snow because it's a rear engine, rear drive. So you have the engine sitting over the drive wheels. So compared to in 1981, most cars were front engine and rear drive. So compared to those, it would have been great in the snow, just because of that weight over those drive wheels. But I don't recommend anybody driving them because, you know, the salt, the destruction that can do to, you know, a classic car. I really try to avoid salty, snowy roads at all costs.
I know I've seen one in passing, and I mean, everyone just turns their heads and looks at it, and it's such a showstopper. How many DeLoreans were built?
So the factory built 9,080 cars.
9,080. And how many are still around, might you think?
Roughly 6,000 and probably less than that in the U.S., maybe 5,000 in the U.S. But that's an educated guess.
What about parts? You know, how hard is it to get them?
So parts are actually pretty readily available. About 70% of the car you can still get as what we call new old stock. So they're factory parts that have never been put on a car. And I would say about 20% of the wear items are being reproduced, like fuel pumps and rubber pieces. And there's some larger components being made, like steering racks and stuff like that. And there's maybe 10% that you have to find used, which is pretty good for a car that's now 43 years old.
Oh, wow. So you don't have as big of a problem in finding all of these parts that need to be replaced as you got the barn find from Douseman.
Yeah. To be honest with you, for a kind of obscure car that's this age, the parts availability is pretty excellent and really somewhat affordable. There really is a lot of stuff that's pretty fairly priced.
Huh, interesting. Was the car fast in its day as a sports car compared to others?
Well, you know, 1981 was like the death of horsepower. I believe it was, even if you compare
this to a Corvette,
it was like their lowest horsepower year was 1981. So there was, you know, gasoline was expensive. The insurance companies had kind of stifled the muscle cars by the early 80s. And it probably was a fairly quick car for its time. They did actually have a prototype that was a twin turbo that was would have been the fastest production car had it gone to production, but they just were not quite there before the company kind of had troubles and went out of business.
Mike McElhattan owns DeLorean Midwest, taking on restorations and servicing of these sports cars immortalized in the 1980s Back to the Future film franchise. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective along the way. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A 1981 DeLorean with less than 1,000 miles on its odometer. It's found in a barn in Dousman. We explore the latest Wisconsin connection to this cult classic American sports car made famous in the Back to the Future film franchise of the 1980s. And you can call in with a question, share at any point, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Mike McElhattan owns DeLorean Midwest in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Let's take a call now. Marcus in Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus. Go ahead.
Hi. So I guess I'm wondering, once you get the whole car put back together, Mike, do you take it out and make sure that it gets up to 88 miles per hour safely, just in case?
I think this is a reference here, Mike. Go ahead.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, you know, you got to love the Back to the Future trilogy. But, yeah, we do actually drive the cars. Anything that we do any engine work on, we want to drive, you know, at least 50 miles just to make sure everything is well sorted. And the cars will get up to 88 miles an hour. It's funny that there was a Jimmy Carter law in the 1980s where the speedometer would only read 85. So in the movie, they actually changed the speedometer to read 95 because they really wanted the number to be 88 of when you traveled through time.
And along traveling through time, I wonder how often you get the flux capacitor, whether they're in stock, to replace.
That just goes with the territory of DeLorean ownership. Of at a car show or at a gas station, you're going to get asked, where's the flux capacitor? For sure.
So you've worked at DeLorean Midwest since 2007, owned the business since 2016. Why own a business that specializes in such a specific car?
Well, to be honest with you, when I first started working for Dave and Julie Swingle, they, you know, they opened, like you mentioned, in 2007. They put an ad in the paper looking for a DeLorean technician, and really I thought I'd be here for 6 months to a year, because it'd be a nice, you know, blip on my resume, and I'd like to, you know, get into restoration of older cars. But I thought there's no way that there's enough business with specifically DeLoreans to be in business for longer than 6 months or a year. And here we are 17 years later, and I've got a shop full of cars, and we've got a backlog of work. So it's kind of funny that over the years we've actually gotten busier, because as the cars get older and then shops like myself have put more and more on the road, like this Dousman car that's been tucked in a barn not getting service for a long time. A lot more interest is in these cars. There's a renewed interest. A lot of the barn finds are getting put back on the road, and we're actually busier than we were when we opened 17 years ago.
So how did you learn the skills to restore them in the first place and run such a niche business like this?
So I, you know, when I came to work at DeLorean Motor Company, I had a 2-year degree in automotive technology, and I had 5 years working in general automotive repair.
Mm-hmm.
But Dave Swingle, who was the original owner, kind of taught me the car. He would say that I taught him kind of how to be a production mechanic, because you're always thinking about book times and trying to get things done in a timely manner. And he definitely showed me, you know, the specifics of the DeLorean.
How long does it take for you to restore a DeLorean for sale on average?
I would say the average car in and out of here, and we'll do anything from a frame-off restoration to an oil change on a car. We only work on DeLoreans, but anything to do with a DeLorean, whether it be interior work or body work or mechanical work or frame-off restoration or simple maintenance, anything to do with a DeLorean we cover. But to answer your question, on average, a car that would come to us in this kind of condition would probably be here for a six-month visit.
Okay. Well, you mentioned oil change, and what would you recommend for DeLoreans, especially, you know, when they're not getting driven? I mean, not as long as the barn DeLorean, but yeah, you know, what would you recommend for oil changes?
It's pretty standard, you know, every 3,000 to 5,000 mile oil change. Typically, people are more changing them by age because a lot of these cars don't get driven a lot of miles a year. But they take an odd oil that's a 2050, which is a really thick oil that was common in Europe at the time where these were built, but kind of an odd oil for today.
Does, like, a barn story like this raise the profile of DeLoreans, perhaps make you busier, but potentially also raise the value of them?
It's, you know, the all the press that this car has gotten is kind of mind-blowing. Nobody would have expected this. I remember after Kevin and I had picked up this car, we went out and had a burger at a local restaurant and just talking about, you know, oh, we hope this video gets some views that we had put together on our DeLorean Nation channel. And we had no idea what was about to happen with the media buzz and the amount of views this video was going to get.
Oh, but it was so fascinating. And you really took us through the whole process of uncovering it and really that discovery and to be able to kind of go along with you on it. I think that really was so interesting.
Yeah, we're glad to have captured that. And yeah, you know, basically for several weeks after that show, it's settled down a little bit now because that's been a while. It's been like three plus months ago now. But for 3 weeks there, I was like a media coordinator, which I don't, not in my, you know, it's not in my resume.
That's not in your wheelhouse.
No, it's definitely not in my wheelhouse. But, you know, I just had I was doing that for like 3 weeks straight with at times it was two and three interviews a day and sending press releases all over the world to use video footage and photo footage. And this story broke in Germany and Switzerland and Australia and just over 45 news stations, broadcast news stations in the United States. So just the reach it's had is pretty incredible to be part of this. And, you know, we love the fact that we were able to capture this story and put it out there for people to see. And this is what we do every day, and it really feels great that, you know, it's just a normal thing for us to go pick up a car out of a barn and fix it. And I've been doing this for 17 years, and it's really great to see the appreciation and feedback from people and the interest in it.
I imagine you've also, through the process, developed a little bit of a relationship, an affinity for this Dousman barn car.
Absolutely, yeah. For Kevin and I, we definitely have a soft spot for this car.
We're talking about DeLoreans with Mike McElhattan, the owner of DeLorean Midwest, based in Crystal Lake, Illinois. You can join in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Jack is here in California. Jack, hi, go ahead.
Hey, I got to tell you, I drove one of those cars, and the DeLoreans are just fantastic cars. Fantastic cars. I understand, at least I think I understand correctly. Can you still have one made in Texas? Is there a place in Texas that still manufactures this car?
Thanks, Jack. Mike.
Yeah, so there's nothing currently being made, but there is a company in Texas that hopes to release a new DeLorean that obviously it's an updated electric version of this car. And that would be really cool to see that come to market. And for a while there there was a program where you could have a car made where they kind of tore the car down and built it from the ground up with everything new they could possibly put on the car. So they called them like a new build DeLorean, but that's been quite a few years since that program has ended.
What are the prospects of DeLorean as a company coming back online and making a new type of car?
Well, the name has been sold, and there is a company based out of San Antonio that hopes to bring a new car new car out, a new line of cars. So it would be a coupe and a sedan and a SUV and all that. And you know, I think they're in the early stages of that, but, you know, it would be cool to see.
I bet it would. And there's also been some more publicity. I think, wasn't it Pepsi? They dropped an ad with the DeLorean. Have you seen that?
So there is a teaser that I've seen out there on that. That I would think there's going to be some type of collaboration between the two. But other than a couple of images they've released on social media, I haven't seen it.
How, with your customers, how attached are they to their DeLoreans?
Very much so. For some of these guys, it's like their children. And I'll tell you a story about when I first started. I would do transport for Dave, and I went to Kentucky to pick up a car. And I think this was very early on, the second car I ever picked up. And I sat in this gentleman's living room on his sofa with my wife, and he kind of peppered us with questions for about 45 minutes. And then at the end of the 45 minutes, he said, okay, you can take my car, because I was willing to pay you to come down and go back. And if I didn't trust you with my car, if I didn't pass his interview, he wasn't going to let the car go. And then he said, well, you're going to have to stay the night, because I want to make sure you're good and rested before you trailer my car home.
And
that people are very attached to these things, and they're serious about who they trust their car with. And we were kind of a newer shop.
Oh, my goodness.
The, reputation that we have now of all these years of service.
But, what a story. Oh, Mike, thank you so much for joining us and taking the time.
No problem, Kate. It was great talking with you today.
Mike McElhattan owns DeLorean Midwest in Crystal Lake, Illinois, refurbishing a 1981 DeLorean found in a Wisconsin barn. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.